From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this half hour focuses on the worst kind of apologies. You know what the worst kind of apology is? It's when someone says, "I'm sorry if you were offended." They don't tell you they're really sorry, do they? They just say they're sorry if you are such a defunct operational being that you were somehow offended by something. And, well, that's sort of what Facebook is doing right now. Facebook making headlines again for all the wrong reasons. And this time it's a mood manipulation study. We've been sort of hearing about it in the news. What we want to do now is dig into what Facebook actually did. There's a bit of a kind of a Cornell connection that we'll get into. We'll get into Facebook's response, and we'll get into what is next. We keep wondering if anything is ever going to take down Facebook, and one of my favorite guests is the guy who says eventually there will be cracks in the facade of Facebook, but right now, nothing much has gotten to them. That's Mike Johansson. Mike is a social media observer. I go to him for social media questions. He lectures at RIT, and this time around, Mike, is everybody leaving Facebook?
Well, lots of people are saying they're going to leave.
they're saying they wish they could leave Facebook.
Yeah. There's a big gap between saying what you want to do and actually doing it. And this happens every time Facebook manages to tick a bunch of people off.
Well, before we get there, let's talk about what they actually did. What did Facebook do this time?
Well, they apparently randomly picked about 700,000 people, like 0.05% of Facebook, and they manipulated what they saw in their news feed. So they manipulated and they looked for, they had an algorithm to find posts that had more positive wording and ones that found more negative wording. And they subjected these people to, over a period of time, the more positive ones, and then another period of time, more negative ones. And they watched how people reacted with their own postings to see if you get exposed to a lot of negative stuff, do you in turn start posting more negative words yourself?
So it's not even a matter of if people were reposting those stories. It was looking for their own status updates, whatnot, mm-hmm. to see if they were showing signs of being cynical, negative, depressed, et cetera.
Sure.
Or happy, upbeat, et cetera.
Right.
And to state the obvious, the 700,000 users had no idea Facebook was doing that.
Right. Right. And you could argue, glass half full argument, that to alert people that you're doing this would spoil the experiment.
Well, and it probably would.
Right.
But then you could ask the question, why do you need to do this to begin with?
Well, from Facebook's perspective, they could have just been curious to see how big a impact Facebook was having on people's lives. You know, for example, There is a lot of research out there, the sort of the herd mentality. Human beings tend to be more positive when they're surrounded by more positive people and vice versa. And they might have been interested to know in Facebook's role in all of this. So again, that's sort of glass half full. The glass half empty approach is what happens when you have a lot of people on your service, Facebook, who are posting a lot of negative stuff. How does that impact you as a business? Are your ads less likely to be clicked on? Now, they haven't talked about this, but I strongly suspect they were also looking to see, are people looking at more or less, fewer ads when they're happy, when they're sad, that kind of thing. It's a business thing, I'm sure.
Yeah, Facebook has demonstrated, if they've demonstrated anything over the years, it's that they often are looking at the bottom line with this. Mm-hmm. And so they may not admit that in this case. And we don't know what they've found exactly, do we?
Well, generally speaking, the findings were published in a peer-reviewed academic journal, and this is where the academics got involved, saying that when more positive things are posted, people tend in turn to say more positive things themselves and vice versa.
So, but that's not surprising. And I think it's interesting to always get confirmation of what you may suspect, but I'm not surprised at that. We've known that. What Facebook is not telling us is if there is a financial component, right? They haven't told us that.
No.
Okay. Now, take me through the ethical possible issues with this, Mike.
Well, from an academic point of view, every institute has an institutional review board, an IRB. And when you do research studies involving human subjects, you're supposed to get IRB approval. IRB approval usually is based on the fact that the human subjects are aware of the fact that they're being tested and have been warned about any possible side effects, consequences of the test. Cornell says that They approved their researcher being involved because he had told them it was only going to be a study of pre-existing data.
Okay, yeah, and that's an important point here, and I don't want to tar Cornell too much, but I think it's important to point out the connection here. So Cornell put out a statement about this. They obviously were somewhat distressed, or they've obviously been contacted for them to release a statement. They were not doing interviews. We asked them to come on the program today. Instead, they referred us to a statement, and I'll go ahead and read the statement in full. It's only a couple paragraphs. Quote, Cornell University Professor of Communication and Information Science Jeffrey Hancock and Jamie Guillory, a Cornell doctoral student at the time, analyzed results from previously conducted research by Facebook into emotional contagion among its users. Professor Hancock and Dr. Guillory did not participate in data collection and did not have access to user data. Their work was limited to initial discussions, analyzing the research results, and working with colleagues from Facebook to prepare the peer-reviewed paper, Experimental Evidence of Massive-Scale Emotional Contagion Through Social Networks, published online June 2nd. Because the research was conducted independently by Facebook and Professor Hancock had access only to results and not to any individual identifiable data at any time, Cornell University's Institutional Review Board concluded that he was not directly engaged in human research and that no review by the Cornell Human Research Protection Program was required. End quote. Good enough for you, Mike?
I'm skeptical. And the key phrase in there is he was involved in discussions before the experiment, apparently. So if he was involved in discussions, I have to believe he had some sway over how the experiment was conducted. Most good researchers want to be sure that they're going to get good data.
The way the statement refers to it as initial discussions, that implies pre-actual research discussions.
Right.
And the one thing they haven't told us is if their people helped design the study.
Right. That's an unknown. We can only conjecture at this point.
If they helped design the study, does that change it for you?
I think so, because we know there was no informed consent. And if there was no informed consent, then I'm pretty sure the IRB probably should not have given approval.
Now, I know that you are not an attorney, but there were even questions about whether this breaks the law in any way. Have you heard that?
Well, all I've read is the much publicized portion of the Facebook user agreement that says that they can pretty much do whatever they want with their data and with their users. Yeah, get out of jail free card.
I was going to say, it's quite the blanket, isn't it?
Yes, yeah.
By the way, we'd love to hear from you. If you are thinking about quitting Facebook as a result, if you've never been on Facebook, or if you have the liberation, I would love to hear from somebody who's walked away from Facebook and just tell us about that. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994, and on Twitter, at Evan Dawson. Twitter's not owned by Facebook, right, Mike? They seem to own everything else. Not yet. Not yet. Okay, so Facebook responds to all of this, by the way. And I started the hour by talking about their lack of apology. Sheryl Sandberg, Facebook's number two, indicates that they're sorry, but they're not really sorry. And here's what they told the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal. Quote, this was part of ongoing research that companies do to test different products, and that's what it was. But it was poorly communicated, Sandberg said. And for that communication, we apologize. We never meant to upset you.
Well, come on. Of course they meant to upset you. That was the experiment.
That was the whole point of the study, right?
Right.
They're going to upset you and see how you respond.
Right, right. Yeah, very poor choice of words there. Yeah,
yeah, that was pretty clunky. Let's grab Patty in Rochester. Patty, you're on Connections. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Evan, thanks for taking my call. You put a shout-out to folks who've walked away from Facebook and you wanted to know quality of life. Life is wonderful post-Facebook. I found the dialogue and the conversation becoming more and more mundane, data and stuff that just had no interest to me. And I found myself becoming almost sort of a voyeur in some ways, not posting anything, but reading what other folks were having for dinner, what their plans were for the weekend. And once I decided that that wasn't a good use of my time, it's been a couple of years that I've gone off of Facebook, and life is great.
So you're feeling liberated
with
your time.
Yeah, I'm totally connected in many other ways. I just find that it's just not it's not a valuable use of time, nor does it provide me any real insight into people. I mean, I think it's a great tool for sharing, for families who live long distances and sharing photographs and that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's other tools that provide that. Facebook, I just think is an example of some deeper issues in our country around this desire to feel connected at all times. And you know, I think to, you know, some of the ancient philosophers who talked about the quality of being alone.
Yeah.
That's where the real thoughts and dreams and ideas come from about time alone. And these social sites, I think, are, especially for younger folks, they're afraid of not being connected at all times.
Yeah, Patty, you talk about ancient philosophers. There's a modern philosopher named Louis C.K.
Oh, yeah, man, I love him.
He said the same thing. He said that we are afraid of our own solitude and emotions,
yeah,
and we turn to these devices to kind of keep us always, you know, distracted from that kind of inner solitude, that kind of a thing. And so that's an interesting point. But before I let you go, you don't miss any connection on there. There's nothing that you miss on there.
Nothing. Oh, you know, for me, it was one of the reasons I decided to move away is because I was finding out that family members and people that I really cared about turned out they had some really interesting political views that really was really disturbing to me, that they were posting and liking things and issues that that are really important to me. And I found it to become an issue in my family. And I decided that I was better off not knowing, you know, that... There were two partiers in my family.
All right, well, we don't need to know which side, right or left, but yes, I get the point here. Patty, thanks for a great call. And Mike, I know you've heard stuff like that before, but when it comes to actual impact on Facebook, even with this, we're not seeing much of a dent yet, are we?
No, a very minor bump in the road. And frankly, as I say, a lot more people talking about leaving than actually leaving. I did a quick Google search yesterday on the term quit Facebook. And of course, dozens and dozens of posts, all kinds of bloggers telling you how to do it and so forth. And this happens every time Facebook has a problem. But the actual numbers overall, very, very small.
My guest for this half hour is Mike Johansson, a lecturer at RIT and a social media observer, helping us take stock of Facebook's latest misstep that never seems to cost Facebook. This is Mike in Rochester. Thanks for calling, Mike.
Hi, glad to be on. Thank you so much.
Go ahead.
There's a couple things going on here that I just wanted to comment on really quickly. Number one is that I think that this is a little bit of a incorrect argument. I think that people are not upset in general about what Facebook has done in terms of this study. I think deep down this is about the Grady argument that's going on right now, and that is the protection of people's privacy. You know, companies all the time they conduct market research, and this is just a form of market research and effective market research and effective research in general. You know, you don't always tell the participants all of the intricacies of the research the experiment that's being conducted. And so, I think that the Sandberg was absolutely right in terms of you know, this wasn't about this wasn't about trying to purposefully hurt people. This was again about trying to sway their emotion to measure their response. But I'm not sure that with the NSA scandal and all these other scandals going around in terms of the protection of people's privacy, that's not more of an integral argument such as that.
I think it's a fair point to make. And first of all, Mike Johansson, reaction to his points there.
I think that's valid. I think as we discussed earlier, the New York Times article today makes a very good point that the good news out of all this is we now know that this is going on for sure. We may have suspected it, but now we know. And that should be cause for pause, I guess. You know, let us think a little bit about this. Is it at all likely that Facebook would want to, for example, manipulate a national election? Probably not. It wouldn't be in their best business interest if it were to ever come out. But at least we know now that, for example, this kind of thing is going on. And perhaps, and I'm certainly not a great fan of piling on regulation, but perhaps there's someone out there that says, you know, sort of like the FCC or someone like that should be keeping an eye on these social networks.
Mike, any follow-up? I mean, I appreciate that, Mike. I mean, I know we've been dogging Facebook here, so I appreciate your comments. Any follow-up there?
No, let me just say this. I know that you posed the question, has anybody, you know, left Facebook
right.
because of this? We as a population in here in the U.S. right now, we do a lot more talking than we do acting. And so I see, you know, everybody's upset because of this revelation, but I as we can already see by the numbers, at least up until this point, Facebook is not really going to suffer, because at the end of the day, people use the tool to connect with friends and family and to keep a track on, keep track of old people that they've seen around and so on. So and it's still going to provide that service. So you know, is it going to affect us personally? Probably not. We don't know really what Facebook's going to use this information for. And honestly, most of us don't care, so we're going to go about our life.
Mike, I think that you're on the money with that. Yes, we are a nation of talkers, and acting is the hard part. And Patty's point about leaving Facebook is interesting for a couple of reasons. Patty left because she's tired of Facebook and finds some liberation not being on a social media site. Other people are talking about leaving, Mike, but they don't find necessarily an alternative. Google Plus was marketed to be an alternative. It hasn't gained nearly the market share, has it?
No, it hasn't. There are some very strong niches on Google Plus on the techie side. It tends to be quite male, quite techie. I know there are groups of like computer programmers, for example, who love Google Plus because the video hangouts and all the other ways you can connect all your Google presences under one login. It's very convenient. But in terms of broad traction, it's not there.
Okay, but you say that there are other alternatives beyond Google Plus. The problem is one of the bigger ones is owned by Facebook. Which one is that?
That would be Instagram. And if you sort of want to look into the tea leaves or look into the future, there are lots of prognosticators around who are saying that, you know, there will come a time in 2 or 3 years from now when Instagram will likely be bigger than Facebook. And that they base that on the fact that the under 25 crowd are drifting away from Facebook. It's sort of been demonstrated for a while now. And teenagers in particular are just not even on it anymore. You know, they're all about the Snapchat and occasionally Twitter, I guess, or WhatsApp and other text messaging type platforms. So if that's the future, then sure, Facebook is going to see a decline.
But I almost look at this as a new generational toy that we have to remember is Facebook is, well, how old technically, Mike?
10 years, yeah, and counting, coming up on 11. Yeah.
But for most of us, I would say, haven't been on Facebook for more than at least 6 or 7 years. That seems like a lifetime, but that's not that much time. I mean, imagine 6 or 7 years from now, what hasn't been put, you know, hasn't been created yet, which could be out there. Mm-hmm. So I think about cell phones, smartphones, et cetera. That's another thing. Smartphones are less than a decade old. This generation right now has got to get used to dealing with these things, and we're all learning how to do it in some kind of moderation, and eventually we will learn how to regulate it within our own lives. But right now, everybody's on Facebook. A lot of kids are texting 100 times a day or more, et cetera. And I wonder if eventually we'll gear it back a little bit. What do you think?
Oh, I think absolutely. I think it's human nature. There's sort of the bell curve, you know, and I think we're at the very top of, you know, we've got to try everything. And I think eventually it'll come down to the one or two things that we find utility in. And whether that's 50 different platforms that the population is spread across, or whether it's 4 or 5, you know, who can say?
You, though, I know to the Mike who called, you're a Mike who has a little bit different take on Facebook, in that you have expressed concern about privacy, et cetera. And your warning to all of us is that, you know, just know the settings and know what's out there, because Facebook hasn't shown a whole lot of concern for our privacy.
Yes, but to give Facebook credit, they have had this little blue dinosaur that's been popping up on people's feeds when they go to post in the last couple of months. People jokingly call it the Zuckersaurus after Mark Zuckerberg. That just reminds you, you haven't looked at your privacy settings for a long time, and lead you right to it, which is,
that's,
you know,
nice.
At least it's a step in the right direction. But yeah, Facebook, I mean, I'm leery about anything on a digital platform, but I'm especially leery of Facebook because there's such a track record there of disregard for the users.
Mike Johansson, RIT lecturer, and where can we find you online, Mike?
Twitter, at MikeJNY. In fact, at MikeJNY on pretty much all the social platforms.
And you're still on Facebook.
Yeah, but that's really just for family and friends. I'm much more active on all the other platforms, so yeah.
Great to see you. Thank you for taking the time to come in and help set us straight with this. I appreciate that.
Certainly.
Mike Johansson, take a short break and come right back, shifting gears and looking at the American Revolution and the story that you did not know. That's next on Connections. Friday on the Next Connections, we're off for Independence Day, and we hope you join us for a special edition of the Capitol Steps. We're back next week with a full slate of Connections, and just a reminder that you can listen to every hour of Connections as a podcast on WXXINews.org/connections. It's your new summer beach reading. Happy Independence Day from all of us on Connections.
Just after film critic Roger Ebert agreed to let Steve James make a documentary about him, Ebert's cancer returned. He died 4 months later. James' new film, Life Itself, includes footage of those final 4 months, during which Ebert allowed James to film him in the hospital. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Steve James and Ebert's widow, Chaz, president of Ebert Productions. Join us.
Tonight at 7.
Welcome back to Connections. My guest now is Professor Tom Slaughter, the Arthur R. Miller Professor of History at the University of Rochester. And Professor Slaughter has written a very interesting book called Independence, The Tangled Roots of the American Revolution. Wonderfully timely, of course, with tomorrow being Independence Day. And we welcome Professor Thomas Slaughter to Connections. Thanks for being here, Professor.
Glad to do it, Evan. Nice to talk to you.
Well, let's start with why you wanted to write this particular book. What, in your mind, told you that this book needed to be written?
Over the course of our lifetimes as American society has professionalized so much, the historical profession, like medicine, like law, like all the other professions, has done the same. We have specialists. And so over the past, 50 years, historians have focused on their own particular areas of expertise. So we have this very rich wealth of monographic studies of the American Revolutionary era. Some people write about the ideas. Some people write about the economy. Some people write about artisans. But we haven't had a synthesis of all those specialized studies for a very, very long time. In fact, somebody asked me when's the last one I could think of. I could be wrong, but I think about 1968 is the last time somebody tried to take all of the writings of the American Revolution and put together in one story. So that was my impulse. My desire was to try to do that. And the way that you do, the way that I do when I've taught the American Revolution, you have to come up with your own story built on the backs of everybody else's work. And so that's what this book does.
I don't want to overstate this, but it already feels like required reading for, say, high school students, because what your book does is it reminds us that the notion of independence was not something that happened very quickly in 1774, 75, 76, that it wasn't the war. The notion of independence had been building almost from the start. My take from reading your work is that the British colonists in America resented the strictures imposed by the British crown very early on, didn't they?
Yeah, I think a lot of the people who crossed the Atlantic, at least those who crossed it voluntarily, were seeking independence from Europe for themselves in some form. Religious independence, economic, personal, communal, political independence. And they built their new lives here in America on a rather highly developed sense of independence, of autonomy. And the flip side of that is that they defined community very narrowly. They saw their village, their parish, as their community. And this, right from the beginning, was a source of conflict within the British Empire, because the men attempting to govern the empire from London had this eventually global view of the task before them. They had to try to govern people in places as far away as India, the Caribbean, North America, a very large stretch of North America. And they thought that the colonists consistently were ignorant of and unwilling to accommodate these global views of community, of empire. And so you have these people at the village level declining to participate, declining to take seriously the laws and to participate in the ways that they thought any loyal subject of the British Crown would do.
But the notion of independence, one of the themes of the book, is the question of whether independence meant actual separation or simply more autonomy within the British Empire. And, you know, let's talk a little bit about that. In fact, you write that back in London, they referred to the colonists as sort of independent or republicanism or republicans as a sort of pejorative, as a way to that you or I might describe an obstreperous child, right?
That's right. When the British accused Americans of being independent, it was not intended as a compliment. What they meant was that they were recalcitrant, that they were resistant to authority, that they were rebellious, that they were very much their own people without looking at the larger, the bigger picture. Whereas Americans would reply, yes, we are independent people. We're loyal first to God, second to our village, third to our family, and they saw that as one of their great strengths. One of their cultural traits that they took greatest pride in was their sense of independence.
And it wasn't until a little bit later on that independence started to mean something different. We're going to get to that in a minute, but I want to go back to some of the events that you write about that, again, this is why one of the reasons this book is such a great pleasure is that it either re-educates us for events that we might have heard about years ago in classrooms but haven't heard about in years, or never were aware of. And I want to cite a couple of examples. First of all, there were questions about what the colonists were really getting for being part of the crown. And I imagine that Richard Coote, the first Earl of Bellomont, as you write about, would have lectured the ungrateful colonists that they were receiving the protection of the crown, as they did during King William's War from 1688 to 1697. Was there this notion that the colonists were getting this protection, and yet back in London, there was a feeling that they were ungrateful for that protection?
Absolutely, and the Americans would have said that they were not ungrateful, that they were proud. Indeed, they were extremely proud to be members of what they saw as the greatest, most powerful empire in the world. They took tremendous pride in the military victories of Great Britain against France, against Spain, and they saw themselves as participants in those victories. Their gratitude, however, did not translate into the sort of eager participation in warfare outside of their locality. And the British always found it difficult to get Americans to enlist in support of efforts mainly to fight against France on the northern border of the British colonies in North America, or against Spain on the southern borders. They were willing to fight to defend their homes, quite literally their homes, but it was very difficult to get them to see the larger picture, to risk their lives and their fortunes, to go very far at all away.
And you also remind us that there were events that, again, happened decades before actual independence was achieved, that happened that might have started to sow the seeds of what eventually happened in the 1770s. And I'm thinking of, for example, Bacon's Rebellion. The colonists who were supposed to feel protected by the crown, you write that they didn't feel protected under Bacon's Rebellion, and that in some ways they rejected the soldiers instead of quartering them. Is that right?
That's right. When the British sent armed forces to put down a rebellion led by this fellow named Bacon, the colonists, whichever side they were on, had large problems with the requirement that they sustain these troops over the longer haul.
And when was this, by the way, this particular rebellion?
This was in 1676, so this was in the late 17th century. And this wasn't the only event of that kind in the late 17th century. Same happened in New York during what was called the Glorious Revolution, 1676 Bacon's Rebellion, 1689 Glorious Revolution, and it happened as late as the 1750s in Nova Scotia as well. Right, so Nova Scotia was the northern borderlands between French Canada and English New England, and as such was a site for lots of fighting over the period that went back to the 17th century on up through the Acadian expulsion in the middle of the 1750s. Now, Americans were willing, indeed eager, to fight against the French on their borders, and they often organized small bands of invaders on their own initiative. They saw themselves as part of an imperial struggle against France, but they really, when it came right down to it, when the British tried to organize the Americans, who tried to get them to fight at the times, in the places, and in the ways that the British wanted them to fight as part of, you know, again, a more global strategy, one that looked at wars that were being fought simultaneously on the mainland of Europe, in the North Atlantic, in the Caribbean, in South Asia, in the Indian Ocean, and in North America. The Americans were never really willing to take part in an imperial struggle on that scale. They just wanted to fight their local battles for their local goals in their own in their own ways, and that created great tensions. Again, Americans saw themselves as brave, independent, courageous, and eager to fight for the empire, whereas the British saw them as stubborn, resistant, ornery, and undisciplined. They always found the Americans to be substandard soldiers, lacking discipline, and unwilling to fight under the leadership of British officers.
Do you attribute the eventual outcome, and I say outcome as if it's one sort of monolithic thing, and it's not. The American Revolution was, again, not just a war. In fact, the war came out of the American Revolution. But do you attribute the separation that happened to that sort of natural urge of those colonists to sort of be more insular? That if they were going to fight, they were going to fight near their town or at least on their continent, that it's hard to hold an empire together over an ocean. So that was always going to be true. Do you attribute the separation that happened to that natural difficulty of holding an empire together, or do you attribute it to a lot of the crown's mistakes, you know, from Bacon's Rebellion and the way that the colonists were treated, to some of the other many other missteps or flare-ups that you write about in this book?
Really great question. I mean, there's enough evidence to point to on mistakes committed by both sides to put the blame pretty much any place you want, depending on how you prioritize that. I think revolutions are really complicated events, and you're right. I start off from John Adams's observation that the American Revolution occurred before 1775, before the battles at Lexington and Concord, before 1776 and the Declaration of Independence. Adams said, the real American Revolution occurred between roughly 1763 and 1775, and it's a process rather than a war. It's a process during which Americans came to believe, a critical mass of Americans came to believe, that they couldn't be both independent and members of the British Empire. So the mistakes that he pointed to, the mistakes of the British Empire, he says these attempts to tax Americans, for example, these attempts to draw lines past which, there's a proclamation line in 1763, draw a line across which Americans were not permitted to settle. Those sorts of attempts to bring order to the empire, to try to force Americans to participate on what the British saw as more equal grounds as members of an empire, that, he said, that Adams said, changed Americans' minds. And it's really this transformation from loyalty, from a belief that they could be both subjects of the British Crown and independent in the ways that mattered to them. That was the real revolution. It was a revolution in the hearts and the minds of Americans. So that's what Adams would point to. You're right that I, looking back as I do, 150 years before the Revolution, say that the seeds of this were always there. What was happening over the course of over a century was that larger processes, economic, demographic, political, imperial, and local, contributed to an environment in which it was just simply increasingly difficult to govern a people like Americans with these core values of independence, this core culture, I think, of independence. And as the economies diversified, as the empire began to experience a global economy and a global politics, it really got a lot harder to integrate Americans into that in a way that they felt were to their advantages and supported their independence as people.
My guest is Professor Thomas Slaughter, the author of Independence, The Tangled Roots of the American Revolution. He is the Arthur R. Miller Professor of History at the University of Rochester. And Professor, you talk about John Adams and his assessment of what led to that, to the revolution. However, here's one of the more absolutely jaw-dropping passages of the entire book, and you have it in the preface. This is John Adams in 1774, still not expecting full separation. And if I can quote here, here's what John Adams wrote, as you quote in the preface, quote, "For my own part, I am of the same opinion that I have been for many years, that there is not spirit enough on either side to bring the question to a complete decision, that we shall oscillate like a pendulum and fluctuate like the ocean for many years to come, and never obtain a complete redress of American grievances, nor submit to an absolute establishment of parliamentary authority, but be trimming between both, as we have been for 10 years past, for more years to come than you and I shall live. Our children may see revolutions and be concerned and active in affecting them, of which we can form no conception." He's saying if there's going to be a full separation from the crown, it was still years or decades or even a generation or two off there, and yet it was months away.
Reminds me of the talking heads, right, on television and the radio, people who predict the outcome of election and get it deadly wrong. I used to watch and listen to those shows much more in the 1970s and then got kind of staggered by how often experts are wrong. And Adams was certainly wrong. He was right in that I think most political observers, almost all political observers that late, would have agreed with him. They would say, look, we've got this. I know we're in conflict with the British Empire. I know the guys who are running the empire right now are really bad at it. They're corrupt. They're short-sighted. They don't really understand things on the ground here in North America. But, you know, we've been bumping along like this for over a century. We'll work it out. I don't know how. You know, maybe these guys will go. New ones will come in. They'll understand it better. But they just did not see that the long-term conflict embedded in this notion of independence, in which Americans acted independently, prided themselves on being independent, and the British condemned them for being rebellious and uncooperative and all of that, that it couldn't be resolved. And that's because as late as 1774, March 1774, maybe even April and May, they would say, we'll be able to work this out, because Americans that late did not want to separate from the British Empire. They wanted to be independent, but they did not want to separate, and they felt that the British forced their hand. After the Boston Tea Party, when the British laid down this set of intolerable, what the Americans called intolerable acts, closed the port of Boston, reorganized the Massachusetts government, closed the Newfoundland fisheries, things that attacked the economy of North Americans, they really felt that that began to suggest an entirely new relationship that they were not going to be capable of bouncing back from. So 1774, fall, Continental Congress, nobody could have imagined anything like that Continental Congress a year before that. 1775, battles at Lexington and Concord, the British shooting Americans. They just didn't predict that that was going to happen.
Can I also ask you, it wasn't just John Adams. Benjamin Franklin told Lord Chatham in 1774 that he had never met a single American, drunk or sober, who had wished for separation. And what I wondered in reading that, Professor, was whether Franklin was embellishing. I mean, surely by 1774 he'd met some people who wished for separation, right?
The ones known to us, very, very few. Thomas Paine didn't get here till 1770, late 1775, he was writing. Patrick Henry, you know, we've heard of a couple. Sam Adams, although he managed to bury his trail very successfully, one suspects, yes, Sam Adams, probably. But not the other founding fathers that we've heard of, and not most people we haven't heard of. Not Thomas Jefferson, not George Washington, not John Adams. No, there were really that was a minority position, a very small minority. But the drift, as Adams told the story, that drift from 1763 was all moving in that direction. There were more and more people who were wondering, you know, when is this going to happen? Everybody, more or less, believed that at some point North America would be separate from the British Empire. But either like Adams, who really thought it'd be, you know, maybe the next generation, maybe his grandchildren, maybe two generations, other people look much farther into the future. I think they imagined it as a more natural evolution that would come from the spreading of the population across the continent, the growth of the economy, the development of the cities, that this would be a more organic process. They were not imagining a war. They had no desire to go to war to separate from the British Empire in 1774.
I think we often find our classrooms now learning about the Tea Party and the Intolerable Acts, which really, as you then write, was the hinge point. That's what changed it. But I'm just so fascinated with the work that you've put together. I want to warn our listeners that if you pick up the book, Independence, The Tangled Roots of the American Revolution, and you start to read it over this long holiday weekend, you may lose some family time because you may not be able to put it down. It really reads like beautiful historical nonfiction, and I want to close on a couple of notes. First of all, sometimes we talk about the founders as if they were all of the same mind. And I should say this book reminds us once again, there wasn't even a majority American opinion that favored war, that favored battle, which was we certainly tend to get wrong. And then after the Revolution, or at least after the establishment of a separation, there's a notion that the way we teach it, it's sort of purified, that we broke away from this oppressive crown and created this wonderful, perfect nation. But it didn't take long for our own independent government to experience the kind of backlash. I think of something else that you've written about, which is the Whiskey Rebellion. And I wonder why we don't learn more about that. But tell us a little bit about the Whiskey Rebellion.
Well, the Whiskey Rebellion, I see as the bookend, the other end of the story that I tell in this book. So the part I haven't told is the middle. The Whiskey Rebellion was a military event in which George Washington led a large army from Philadelphia across the state of Pennsylvania against farmers who refused to pay a whiskey excise tax. these farmers and others like them, because the government was not collecting this tax anywhere on the other side of the Appalachian Mountains, in North Carolina and Virginia, in Pennsylvania. It was not collecting it anywhere in these rural areas. But Washington decided to try to, that he had to try to put it down one place, and decided this would be the best place to try to put it down. And you're absolutely right, because what these farmers are saying is, we've got taxation without representation. Here we've got another, what they called an internal tax. It's like the stamp tax. It's like the Stamp Act in 1765. And like the British government in 1765, this new federal government is taxing us unreasonably at the localities, affecting our economy in ways that are not understood by politicians back east. And were outvoted every time, so they felt underrepresented or not represented at all. And I guess that is the core of what I have to say, Evan, is that the American Revolution we would like to remember as a unifying event. But in fact, it was both. War does both unify and divide people. We know that. And this war was no different. Yes, we never had more than 40 to 45% of Americans fighting on what became the winning side. There were many Americans who switched sides depending on who seemed to be winning. We had Americans fighting against Americans as well as Americans fighting against British soldiers. We had what was more of a civil war than the war we call the Civil War. The American Revolution was more of a civil war, by which I mean it was much more likely in the American Revolution that you'd be fighting against your own relatives or you'd be fighting against your own neighbors. Here in New York, we had a large loyalist population. Other places, there were other pockets in which this was true also. In the Civil War, that was pretty much a war between the states. So you had people from one region fighting people from another region. The American Revolution was a very brutal war. There was torture. There was a lot of violence that people would have to overcome within their communities locally, as well as coming together nationally to try to make this thing work. So when we celebrate our independence, we need to understand the complexity of that. And we also need to recognize that the flip side of this independence that we treasure is this tendency to define community very narrowly, which we still do, and in a lot of ways perhaps to our disadvantage. Are the suburbs the same community as the city? Are the states that are downwind from where fossil fuels are burned, part of the same community? When we affect the climate, that's a global problem. When most of our clothing is produced in Asia, are those people a member of our community? We run up against the limits of our willingness to define community broadly in both a national and a global sense all the time. We love our independence. We would love to share it, to export it. How's that going in Iraq right now? How's it going in Afghanistan with the disputed presidential election? It's very difficult to share that independence because it is such a complicated culture that we have here, one that affects us within our nation, right? The president says we're going to try to limit the impact of fossil fuels on states that are downwind, and that affects the independence, as they see it, of the fossil fuel producing states. So that still is with us. That's still who we are. It's still part of our legacy from the Revolution and part of what we will leave to the next generation of Americans after us.
Some of the rhetoric that gets most commonly bandied about these days on the far right or the far left is that whoever is in political power is some kind of despot, and the founders would never have tolerated it, and the founders were X, Y, and Z, and we've gotten so far astray of it. I brought up the Whiskey Rebellion because it took Jon Stewart on The Daily Show to remind us that when the whole Cliven Bundy episode came up and you had You had certain people saying, look, the federal government is going to crush these poor farmers, and they're standing up to them, and George Washington never would have done that. And in fact, George Washington did exactly that.
And these
complex questions of how to tax, how to make sure people are represented fairly, how to make sure power is balanced and checked, have been going on since the seeds of this country more than 100 years before the American Revolution. Do you agree?
I absolutely agree, as has the dispute that you're pointing to there. Are the documents, are the texts, are the words, are the ideals that come out of the American Revolution fixed and immutable, which is what some members of our Supreme Court, some judges believe, the people who believe in strict construction and what they call originalism, that we are bound by a set of fixed principles that unite us as a nation. Others, I think more historically realistically, see us as the heirs of ideals that came out of the 18th century, ideals that we need to consider, to reconsider, to try, however imperfectly, to apply in sets of very, very different circumstances. And that's an argument, you're right, that's an argument that continues and is probably not going to be resolved anytime soon.
But it doesn't mean that our country is going to be falling apart or is some sort of a lost soul in the wilderness, no matter who's in power, what party is in power. I'm an optimist that says this country was imperfectly but beautifully founded, and your book reminds me that it was much more complex than we often realize, and it was an absolute beautiful work of scholarship that you've done here. Thank you for taking the time, and thank you for writing the book.
All right, you're welcome, and thank you so much. It's, as an author, always a pleasure to talk to an interviewer who's actually read your work. So thank you very much.
My thanks to author Thomas Slaughter from the University of Rochester, and to you for listening. To Dave Campo, our engineer behind the glass. Happy Independence Day, Rochester, Finger Lakes, Western New York. We will see you on member-supported public radio on a Monday.